Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Bareback Facts, and today we're going to be talking about mafiosi royalty, Lucky Luciano, considered by many to be the father of modern organized crime in the United States, one of the most wanted mafiosi in history. And today, it's all about him, the original OG, the original godfather himself, the big man. And today, we're going to be talking about his life and how he got to where he eventually ended up. So, let's dive right in. Now, Lucky Luciano was an Italian-born American mobster best known for engineering the structure of modern organized crime in the United States. But that's only part of the story. Now, he was born Salvatore Lucanie in Sicily in 1897. Charles Lucky Luciano became one of the most notorious criminal figures of the 20th century. He came to the United States with his family in 1906. Unable to speak English, Luciano struggled in school. He preferred to learn about how to make it on the streets of New York's Lower East Side. One of Luciano's first rackets was getting his schoolmates to pay him for protection. If they didn't cough up the money, Luciano was liable to give them a beating himself. Now, he was born November 24th, 1897, but soon grew into a hellion, as you no doubt have already noticed. He got kicked out of school in 1914 and graduated to much larger ventures. While he worked as a clerk for a hat company for a time, he managed a budding criminal career as well. The teenage Luciano befriended Jewish gang members Meyer Lansky and his associate, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, who would become two of his most important allies. He also became affiliated with Giuseppe Joe the Boss Masserio's criminal operation. Now, Luciano got involved shortly after this in dealing drugs, which led to his first major run-in with the law in 1916. He was caught selling heroin and would serve only 6 months at a reformatory for the crime. Now, during the 1920s, the prohibition of alcohol created opportunities for criminals to make an exorbitant amount of money. Luciano became one of the big six of bootlegging, along with childhood friend Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Luis Lepke Buchalter, Jacob Gura Shapiro, Abner Longy Zwillman as well. These unscrupulous individuals dominated the illegal liquor trade on the East Coast. Luciano was also an associate of Arnold Rothstein, also known as the Big Bankroll, who had gambling and bootlegging operations of his own. In 1929, Luciano lived up to his nickname Lucky by surviving an incredibly savage attack. He was abducted by a group of men who beat and stabbed him a number of times. Left for dead on a beach in Staten Island, Luciano was discovered by a police officer and taken to the hospital. It was unclear who had ordered this violent attack on him, but some speculated it was the police or top crime boss Masseria himself. Masseria was in a turf war with rival boss Salvatore Maranzano around this time, and Luciano had worked for Masseria for years, but he later supported Maranzano. He helped arrange for Masseria to meet an incredibly grisly end in April of 1931. Rising to power, Luciano took over Masseria's position as the top boss, with Maranzano's approval, of course. He became a leader of one of the city's five families, taking his place alongside such infamous figures as Joseph Bonanno, Joseph Profaci, Tommy Gagliano and Vincent Mangano. Unfortunately for Luciano, Marizano soon began to view him as a threat and ordered a hit on him. But Luciano was able to strike him first, having some of his men take out Marizano in his office in September of 1931. So as you can see, Luciano knew how to move very quickly. Now, with his rival vanquished, Luciano focused on improving how criminal gangs did business. He sought to create a national organized crime network to quell any conflicts, manage disputes, and establish guidelines between the different operations. In addition to the heads of the five families, he brought in other crime figures from across the country, including Chicago's own Al Capone. This new entity, sometimes known as the Commission, took organized crime to an entirely new level. In the early 1930s, Luciano began enjoying the high life. He lived at New York's luxurious Waldorf Towers, part of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel under the name Charles Ross. Flush with cash, Luciano looked the part of a wealthy businessman, wearing custom-made suits and riding around in chauffeur-driven cars, living the good life. But the good times soon came to an end as Thomas E. Dewey was appointed to serve as a special prosecutor to look into organized crime in 1935. Of Lucky Luciano, I'd like to double back a little bit and get a little bit closer to the man that was Salvatore Lucchini, or Charles Lucky Luciano. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Luciano was born on November 24th in 1897. He was born in La Cara Fredda, Sicily, Italy, and his parents, Antonio and Rosalia Caparelli Lucchini, had four other children: Bartolomeo, born in 1890, Giuseppe, born in 1898, Philippa, born in 1901, and Concetta. Now, Luciano's father worked in a sulfur mine in Sicily before their move. His father was an incredibly ambitious and persistent man and eventually managed to move his family to America. Luciano recounts in his semi-autobiography, The Last Lament of Lucky Luciano, the mafia story in his own words, that his father always had a new Palermo-based steamship company calendar each year and would save money for the boat trip by keeping a jar under his bed. He also mentions in the book that his father was too proud of asking for money, so instead his mother was given money by Luciano's cousin in secret named Rotolo, who also lived in La Cara Fredda. Now, in April of 1906, at the age of nine, his family immigrated. They settled in New York in the borough of Manhattan, which was a popular destination for Italian immigrants at the time. And at the age of only 14, he got into organized crime. And it was all sparked by winning $244 in a dice game. Lucky Luciano was lucky before he survived his vicious attack, and he saw this luck as the beginning of a very lucrative career in organized crime. Making it to the big time and becoming a master of his own mafia family, Luciano started his own small gang and was eventually a member of the old Five Points Gang. For those of you unfamiliar with the Five Points Gang, they were a 19th and early 20th century criminal organization primarily composed of Irish Americans based in the 6th Ward of Manhattan, which is also known as the Five Points. Now, they eventually managed to recruit a number of individuals from other backgrounds, such as Johnny Torrio, Al Capone, and of course Lucky Luciano, and these individuals became prominent criminals in their own right. But this was sort of the starting point for these individuals, and Lucky Luciano did the exact same thing as these other men did. Now, never fret, his parents weren't 100% in love with the idea. In fact, after Luciano quit his job and dropped out of school, His parents attempted to send him to the Brooklyn Truant School. Unfortunately for them, he ditched. Now, unlike other street gangs, once Luciano joined the Five Points Gang, Luciano offered protection to youngsters from Italian and Irish gangs for 10 Jewish youngsters from Italian and Irish gangs for 10 cents per week. In addition to that, he was also learning the trade of prostitution and pimping people out around the years of World War I. And as I mentioned before, it was during this time that Luciano met his closest associates, but more specifically, he met his closest friend, Meyer Lansky, his future business partner, and the only man that he really, truly trusted over the period of his long criminal career. Now, in addition to Lucky Luciano surviving a savage beating at the hands of several men earlier in the 20s, he also had his throat slashed and survived it as well because he refused to work for another mob boss. A few individuals decided that it was best to cut his throat so that he couldn't rat. Not only did Lucky Luciano not rat, he managed to overcome these injuries as well. So just a little bit more background there on Lucky for you guys. Give you an idea of what kind of man we're dealing with here. Now, Luciano's luck would run out, unfortunately, in the year 1936, as he and eight members of his vice racket were brought to trial in May of that year. They were convicted on charges of extortion and prostitution charges in June and sentenced to 30 to 50 years in jail. Luciano himself was sent to the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York, and it was nicknamed Siberia by some. The remote prison was near the Canadian border. Luciano tried to appeal his case, but the court would uphold his conviction. Now, whilst in prison, Luciano offered to help in the war effort during World War II by using his criminal connections in Italy to advance the Allies' cause there. After the war, Luciano received parole and a deportation order. He would return briefly to Italy and then travel to Cuba, where he then met up with some of his old cohorts in crime, including Meyer Lansky and, of course, Bugsy Siegel. Now, in 1947, the Cuban government would send Luciano back to Italy, where he remained under incredibly close surveillance. He was not allowed to leave Naples, where he spent the remainder of his days, and according to some reports, he still had his hands in narcotics trafficking throughout this entire period. Luciano considered sharing the inside details of his life story over the years, and in an odd twist of fate, he would later suffer a fatal heart attack at a Naples airport in January of 1962. As it happens, Luciano had been there to meet with a film and television producer. Now, after hundreds gathered in Naples for his funeral, Luciano's body was returned to the United States, and he was buried in the family's vault at St. John's Cemetery in Queens, New York. While he spent much of his life as the notorious Charles Lucky Luciano, he was laid to rest by his parents under his birth name, Salvatore Lacagna. Now, his empire continues on to this day, and his former underboss, Vito Genovese, eventually would take control of his organization and become the head of what is now referred to as the Genovese crime family. Genovese died later in 1969. So what is the overall impact of Lucky Luciano, and how do we determine what lasting impacts a man like this has had? Well, we've kind of looked at an overarching timeline of his life. But it's important also that we look at La Cosa Nostra itself, or the Italian Mafia, to give you a kind of insight into how Lucky Luciano impacted not only organized crime, but also how he changed the game and how he changed the way that government officials and police enforcers and police and law enforcement had to go after the mafia, how they he made things for them. So in order to do that, we have to go back a ways and look at the La Cosa Nostra a little bit better and a little bit closer. And we're going to do that. But before we do that, we're going to take a short commercial break. I know it's a little bit early in the show, but I feel like we're moving on pretty swiftly. So before we take a commercial break, we have a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's wacky, he's funny, and he's crazy, and of course, he's totally driven. You're going to want to check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com. And when we return, we're going to talk a little bit about the a little bit more of the early history of La Cosa Nostra and what they were doing before Lucky Luciano came along and how Lucky Luciano really did change the game for the mafia and the way that the law enforcement officials had to change their approach to pursuing them. So we'll take a short break and we'll dive into that on our return.
I'm black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mafia. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to the show, guys. And, of course, thank you to all the sponsors who make it all possible for us to stay on and do what we do. Guys, I promised you before the break, we'd talk a little bit about the history of the organization known as La Cosa Nostra. And we're going to do exactly that. So the first known Sicilian Mafia member to immigrate to the U.S. was named Giuseppe Esposito. He and six other Sicilians fled to New York City after murdering the chancellor and vice chancellor and a vice chancellor of his Sicilian province and 11 wealthy landowners. He was arrested in New Orleans in 1881 and extradited to Italy. Now, New Orleans was also the site of the first major mafia incident in the United States. On October 15th of 1890, the New Orleans police superintendent David Hennessy was murdered execution style, unfortunately, by someone involved with the mafiosi. Now, hundreds of Sicilians were arrested, and 19 were eventually indicted for the murder. An acquittal generated rumors of widespread bribery and intimidated witnesses. Outraged citizens of New Orleans organized a lynch mob, and they would kill 11 of the 19 defendants. Two were hanged, 9 would be shot, and the remaining 8 would escape. And the American Mafia has evolved over the years as various gangs assumed and lost dominance over the years. For example, the Black Hand Gangs around the 1900s, the Five Points Gang in the 1910s and 20s in New York City, and of course Al Capone's Syndicate in Chicago in the 1920s. But it's not until 1951 that a U.S. Senate committee led by Democrat Estes Cavour of Tennessee determined that a sinister criminal organization, later defined and known as La Cosa Nostra, operated in this nation. Now, 6 years later, the New York State Police uncovered a meeting of major La Cosa Nostra figures from around the world and around the country in the small upstate New York town of Appalachian. Now, most of the attendees were arrested. The event itself was a catalyst that changed the way that law enforcement was forced to battle organized crime. Now, if we look at the early history of La Cosa Nostra, we get a pretty clear picture of where Lucky Luciano factors in. Now, I mentioned by the end of the 20s, Lucky Luciano has worked his way up the ranks by the end of the 20s. But by the end of the 20s, there were two primary factions that had emerged in the groups in New York. One led by Joseph Masseria, who controlled the groups that sparked the so-called Castellammare's War in 1928 when he tried to gain control of organized crime across the entire country. The war itself ended in 1931 when Salvatore Maranzano conspired with Masseria's top soldier, Charles Lucky Luciano, to have Masseria killed. Now, Maranzano emerged at that time as the most powerful mafia boss in the country, setting up 5 separate criminal groups in New York and calling himself Boss of Bosses. Now, Maranzano was the first leader of the organization that has now been dubbed La Cosa Nostra, and he established its code of conduct, set up the family divisions and structure, and enacted procedures for resolving disputes between the families. Two of the most powerful La Cosa Nostra families known today as the Genovese and Gambino families emerged from Maranzano's restructuring efforts. At this time, he named Luciano the first boss of what would later be known as the Genovese family. Now, of course, as I mentioned before, Luciano beats Maranzano to the punch, and less than 5 months later, sent 5 men dressed as police officers to his office to murder him, which they in fact succeed at. But the story does not end there for La Cosa Nostra, and it certainly doesn't end with Luciano. Now, with Maranzano out of the way, Luciano became the most powerful mafia boss in America and used his position to run La Cosa Nostra like a corporation. He set up an organization known as the Commission, set up to rule all La Cosa Nostra activities. And the Commission included bosses from 7 different families and divided the different rackets between the families. Each family was set with a certain handle on a certain part of the family's, of the overall family's business. Division of responsibilities and a division of profits. In 1936, I mentioned before that Luciano was sentenced to 30 to 50 years in prison, but was released 10 years later and deported to Italy, but he never did return. Now, there, Once in Italy, however, he became a liaison between the Sicilian Mafia and La Cosa Nostra. When he was convicted, Frank Costello became acting boss because underboss Vito Genovese had fled to Italy to avoid a murder charge. Now, Genovese's return to the States was cleared when a key witness against him was poisoned and the charges were dropped. Costello led the family for approximately 20 years until May of 1957, when Genovese took control by sending soldier Vincent the Chin Gigante to murder him. Costello survived the attack, but relinquished control of the family to Genovese, who named it after himself. Attempted murder charges against Gigante were dismissed when Costello refused to identify him as the shooter, and in 1959, it was Genovese's turn to go to prison following a conviction of conspiracy to violate codex laws, where he received a 15-year sentence, but continued to run the family through his underlings from his prison cell in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, about this time, Joseph Valachi, a made man, was sent to the same prison as Genovese on a narcotics conviction and labeled an informer. He survived three attempts on his life behind bars. Still in prison in 1962, he killed a man he thought Genovese sent to kill him and was sentenced to life for the murder. The sentence was a turning point for Valachi, who decided at this point to cooperate with the U.S. government. Recruited by FBI agents, he appeared before the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of September of 1963 and testified that he was a member of a secret criminal society in the United States known as La Cosa Nostra. He later revealed to the committee numerous secrets of the organization, including its name, its structure, power bases, codes, swearing-in ceremonies, members, informants, and pretty much the whole shebang. In 1969, several years after he began cooperating with the FBI, Vito Genovese died in his prison cell. Now, by then, the Genovese family was under the control of Philip Benny Squint Lombardo. And unlike the bosses before him, Lombardo preferred to rule behind his underboss. His first was named Thomas Eboli and was murdered in 1972. Following this, Lombardo then promoted Frank Funzi Thierry as his front man. 80s, the Genovese hierarchy went through several changes. Thierry, recognized down the street as the Genovese family boss in the 1970s, was convicted for operating a criminal organization through a pattern of racketeering that included murder and extortion. Then later, Anthony Fat Tony Salerno was then fronted as boss until 85, when he and the bosses of the other four New York families were convicted for operating a criminal enterprise, the LCN Commission, or the La Cosa Nostra Commission. Lombardo, his two captains in prison, and his health failing turned full control of the family over to Gigante, the man who tried to kill Costello 30 years earlier. Now, in 86, a second member turned against the Genovese family when Vincent Fish Cafaro, a soldier and right-hand man to Anthony Salerno, decided to cooperate with the FBI and testify. Now, according to his sworn statement, Gigante ran the family from behind the scenes while pretending to be mentally ill. Cafaro said his behavior helped further insulate Gigante from authorities when he ran the Genovese family's criminal activities. Gigante's odd behavior and mumbling while he walked around New York's East Village in a bathroom earned him the nickname the Odd Father. After an FBI investigation, he was convicted of racketeering and murder conspiracy in December of 1997 and sentenced to 12 years. Another FBI investigation led to his indictment on January 17th of 2002, accusing him of continuing to run the Genovese family from prison. He pled guilty to obstruction of justice in 2003 and later died in prison in December of 2000, in the same federal hospital where the Gambino family leader John Gotti had died 3 years earlier. The Genovese crime family was once considered the most powerful organized criminal family in the nation. Members and their numerous associates engaged in drug trafficking, murder, assault, gambling, extortion, loan sharking, labor racketeering, money laundering, arson, gasoline, bootlegging, and an infiltration of legitimate businesses. The Genovese family members were also involved in stock market manipulation and other illegal frauds and schemes, as evidenced in the FBI's mob stocks investigation. So if we look back, this is an organization with humble beginnings. It starts out rather small, an organization of a group of small families who got together and decided it was time to break criminal bread. But Lucky Luciano changed the game. Fortunately for La Cosa Nostra, he made it that much easier for the government and for law enforcement agencies to target La Cosa Nostra. In part, La Cosa Nostra is a failed organization, in part because of the fact that the structure of this organization is incredibly reliant on the people that are lower on the totem pole. And when these individuals got pinched and realized they weren't benefiting quite as much as these upper bosses were benefiting from the organization, it was really easy for them to flip, knowing that they were going to do 30 years in prison if they got caught. The romanticizing of them as being incredibly loyal to the end appears to have not been as true as, you know, films seem to lead on. Now, in another instance, Lucky Luciano, of course, he changed the game for the mafia. He made it incredibly profitable. These mafia families began to net incredible profits because of the way that he restructured them. This organization, known as the Commission, not only divided up the tasks of certain parts of their industry, whether it be prostitution, the selling of bootleg liquor, the selling of narcotics, hustling for protection money, loan sharking, killing people, committing damages to people's property, whatever the case may be. These responsibilities were divided amongst these families, giving a sense of not only organization and purpose for each one of these families, but also sharing the load of the work, and thereby opening up paths of communication for them as well. Nobody was as concerned about infighting over resources anymore, because resources were divided up as evenly as possible amongst the five families. Lucky Luciano managed to do this, and he managed to keep these families on the same page. La Cosa Nostra became incredibly influential and powerful because of his ability to see the big picture. The big picture was, at the end of the day, it's all about dollar signs. And for Lucky Luciano, that's what it had always been about. So he developed La Cosa Nostra. He developed this concept of La Cosa Nostra, not of being a much more organized, much more a multi-headed beast, if you will, where you couldn't just simply cut off one head of the organization. You had to cut off multiple heads. And we see this in this minor history that I gave of La Cosa Nostra, and it's a breakdown by the FBI itself, that even when Lucky Luciano was sort of out of the game, he was still very much in the game. Still very much, despite being removed by a full continent in an ocean away, he was still incredibly involved in what was going on with this organization. He had his hands in every piece of the pie. So it was incredibly impressive on his part to still command such influence despite being so far away. In addition to him being able to control these five families, eventually it goes from five to seven families. This organization that he developed, called the Commission, was composed of the bosses from the seven families, and therefore it made it less likely that there would be infighting and conflict over resources, because each one of these bosses going to have was going to have a say in where money was going. They were going to have a say in not only the flow of profits, but they were going to have a say in the flow of responsibility, and they were going to have access to one another's information networks. And this made things a lot more complicated for law enforcement officials and government officials, because this gave this massive criminal organization a huge amount of influence and power. They had access to vast sums of money. They had the ability to bribe their way out of most things. And if they couldn't bribe their way out, they would kill their way out by paying people to get the job done. But what's perhaps even more impressive about Lucky Luciano is, and what probably shows even more of his success, is his ability to manipulate his way into an even better situation for himself. He proved the value of his influence and the full reach and authority that he had when he was able to bargain with the United States government to use his organization to undermine the efforts of the Axis powers during the First World War, or during the Second World War, I should say. So his ability to not only organize and restructure these families into a cohesive organization was not even the most impressive thing about Lucky Luciano. It was his ability to seize upon opportunities and realize that he had the ability to not only organize, and not only was it his ability to seize on opportunities that he was recognizing, but it was his ability to apply his resources to getting the things that he needed. So despite the fact that Lucky Luciano is deported, he's still able to employ this massive organization to do his bidding from afar, including improving the comforts of his own life in Italy, providing protection and security for himself, and keeping himself alive well into his old age. If you're familiar at all with criminal history, and a lot of these individuals, they don't live particularly long. Most of these dons and criminals, if we just go back and look at this minor history of the La Cosa Nostra, these guys aren't living very long. They're not really making it for very long. I mean, Maranzano is only the head of the family for 5 months, and then he's murdered. Same thing again. You know, Genovese, Costello is in charge of the family 20 years, which sounds like a long time until he's almost brutally murdered. These guys, they don't really last on the outside very long. But still, Lucky Luciano managed to persist longer than most of these guys did. Luciano doesn't die till 1962. So he lived quite a while. He lasted quite a long time. And to give you an idea of how powerful of a man Luciano ended up being, his accomplishment was only duplicated one other time. The only other boss to have complete control of the commission and every other mafia family in the U.S. was Gambino. Now, in popular culture, proponents of the mafia and its history often debate as to who was the greater between Luciano and his contemporary Al Capone. The much publicized exploits of Capone with the Chicago outfit made him the most famous mobster in American history, but he did not exert influence over the mafia families as Luciano did in creating and running the commission. And interestingly enough, in 1998, Time magazine characterized Luciano as the criminal mastermind among the top 20 most influential influential builders and titans of the 20th century. This should give you an idea of just how powerful and influential Luciano became in his life. We talk a lot about Al Capone, but Al Capone was not named among the top 20 most influential builders and industrial titans of the 20th century. You think about La Cosa Nostra as a business. We think about the Mafia family because we think about movies. We think about The Godfather. We think about movies such as Mobsters or The Untouchables or Boardwalk or we get the shows, you know, Boardwalk Empire, you know, and even the television show The Making of the Mob. These shows don't even fully capture the full-on influence and powers these individuals attained during their lifespan. Lucky Luciano may not have the big name that Al Capone had while he was alive. He may not have garnered the celebrity that Al Capone had, but when Al Capone was backed into a corner, he was pretty much done in. And while he did live like a Don boss for part of his time in prison, he got assaulted brutally in prison. Lucky Luciano, he didn't suffer such a fate. Not only did he negotiate his way out of prison, he managed to prove the staying power and the reach of his influence to the U.S. government in his role in undermining the efforts of the Italian government during the Second World War, and negotiated his way out of prison. He basically got pardoned. He got a get-out-of-jail-free card, and spent the rest of his life pretty well off in Italy, fully protected, able to run his entire criminal empire despite not being in the United States. He ran everything from Sicily. He even ran parts of the Sicilian mob. He created an empire, and this empire lasted even some years after his death, as we saw in the composed history by the FBI of the La Cosa Nostra. It lasts until 1986, officially the five families don't really lose their full influence until 2003. And then Gigante, the last boss, dies in 2005, the last major boss of the five in 2005, but they don't stop being an influence and a pain in the United States government's ass until 2000. We look at what Luciano takes over in 1931 and establishes the La Cosa Nostra as an organization. He establishes the committee, the commission. It organizes this massive division of powers between the families. Runs this entire business, survives prison, survives attempts on his life, negotiates his way out of prison with the United States government, finds himself in somewhat temporary exiles in Italy before nearly returning to the United States to officially reclaim his throne before dying of a heart attack in Naples. And then when he dies, he gets to come back home. He gets celebrated as not only an influential man who built a massive empire, and built a massive empire he did, but he even gets his last wish, which is to be buried alongside his family in the United States. So we're talking about an incredibly remarkable individual. This man was a criminal, a crime lord, and yet he was named among the top 20 most influential builders and industrial titans or financial titans in history. That is quite a feat. That is incredibly impressive. When you look at some of these other, you know, some of the big famous criminals like the John Dillingers, the Al Capones, none of these guys achieved what Lucky Luciano did. And despite the fact that he's a criminal, that he was a criminal while he was alive, and no doubt a pretty vicious guy, pretty ruthless and cutthroat, you have to respect this guy's accomplishments. I mean, this is incredibly impressive that he's able to do, establish this national crime syndicate, establish this organization, and not only does he establish it, but it lasts decades after his death. He dies in 1962, and it's not even until the 80s that things start to fall apart. Excuse me, that things in his organization start to fall apart. It takes over 20 years for things to start going south, really, for his organization. Because of the way that he organized the five families, because of how he divided the power and responsibilities of the five families, and because of how rigid, structured, and ordered their rules and regulations within this commission he created were, these seven families and the original five among them managed to not only coexist with, you know, I mean, yeah, they did have some inner competition here and there, but not only did they manage to predominantly, for the most part, coexist together and make a lot of money, they were able to have an incredible amount of bargaining power with the United States government. They were also able to kind of, for the most part, conceal themselves from authorities and pretty much do whatever they wanted to do for decades. We go back to 1931 when he established the commission, and it lasts until, it doesn't start breaking down until 1986. That is 55 years of a successful business. We got businesses now that haven't lasted. We've got businesses that haven't lasted that long. We've seen businesses come and go within a few years. This is 55 years before his business starts to turn sour. 55 years. And then it doesn't even break down until another 20 plus, until another 18, 19 years. It doesn't start breaking down until 2003. And it doesn't really officially die off until 2005. That's an incredible feat, and one that I don't think we will ever see duplicated, and that's probably for the best. But no doubt about it, guys, Lucky Luciano was an incredibly influential man, and not only was he influential in terms of politics and in terms of crime, but we can look at how he's portrayed in popular culture. There is a laundry list of films, television series, books, documentaries dedicated to him. Let's go down the list. There's The Deported, comes out in 1950, based on his life. The Valachi Papers, in 1972. Lucky Luciano, a biographical film, in 1973. Lepke, 75. Brass Target, in 78. The Cotton Club, in 84. Mobsters in 1991, Bugsy in 1991, Billy Bathgate in 1991, White Hot, The Mysterious Murder of Thelma Todd in 1991, The Outfit 1993, Hoodlum 1997, Bonanno and Godfather Story 1999, Lansky 1999, The Real Untouchables 2001, and then he appears in a number of TV series, The Untouchables series from 1959 to 1962, he appears in The Witness in 1960 to 1961, The Gangster Chronicles in 1981, Boardwalk Empire, of course, a more recent one from 2010 to 2014. He was portrayed by Vincent Piazzi in that. The Making of the Mob, New York, 2015. He appeared in that. He was an integral figure in that particular TV series. He's also in the documentary series Mafia's Greatest Hits. Luciano features in one of the primary episodes of it. And here we have a number of books also dedicated to his life. We have Luciano's Luck, written by Jack Higgins in 1981. And it's a fictional work based on Luciano's supposed war efforts in World War II. The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano is semi-autobiographical. I mentioned it earlier, based on his entire lifespan. It's dictated by him, to Martin A. Gosch and Richard Hammer in 1975. And then Live by Night, written by Dennis Lehan. He appears as a minor character in that. in the story of a fictional gangster named Joe Coughlin, and is further mentioned in the sequel World Gone By. Lucky Santangelo, named after Lucky Luciano in the Santangelo novels written by Jackie Collins. But, I mean, you look at the massive amount of influence this guy commanded, and look, even in death, he has still managed to reach beyond the grave and for decades prominently in movies. And you could even argue, honestly, that he is, despite not being portrayed specifically in the film The Godfather, is a massive influence on that that film series as well. You know, it's incredibly impressive to see the legacy of an individual like Lucky Luciano have that much of an impact on our popular culture and on our own history. But that's all I've got for you guys today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you learned a lot about Lucky Luciano. Hope you guys are enjoying this. We're going to continue with the biographical works in the coming days. This week, Friday, actually at 5 p.m., we're going to talk about the notorious serial killer, the Casanova Killer. So we're going to be talking about that. John Paul Knowles, for those of you who don't know, went on a little bit of a killing spree in 1974 and earned the moniker the Casanova Killer, given to him by authorities in their hunt and their pursuit of him. But don't you worry, guys. We get to him. I can assure you, he meets justice. Unlike Lucky Luciano, who really doesn't really face the music all that much, as you learned today. But this has been another edition of the Bareback Facts, and I hope you guys enjoyed the show. As always, it's always a pleasure to do these. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that you guys can also catch me Sunday mornings at 9 to noon. That's Eastern time. Straight Football Talk with Teddy the Bear Tate and Austin Thomas, of course, myself. I will be there, as I always am. As I hope you enjoyed. Hope you guys are really enjoying our content, putting a lot of work into it. Before we sign off, though, I want to give you guys some source material to look at because, as you know, I like it when people go double-check me. You guys, I like to give you guys some source material to go look at for yourselves. I don't want to just teach you guys. I want you guys to learn for yourselves. It's always good to get your own perspective on these things. And so, of course, I'm going to recommend the autobiography, The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano by Martin A. Gosch. I'm, of course, going to recommend that. Crying out loud, it's his autobiography. But you can also look at Mobster Biography, Charles Lucky Luciano. You can look at Boardwalk Gangster, The Real Lucky Luciano by Tim Newwork. And you can also look at Lucky Luciano, Mysterious Tales of a Gangland Legend by Christian Cipollini. I hope you guys will take a look at these books. There's a good... this one in particular won a position as a finalist in the USA's Best Book Award, so definitely worth a look. But that's been our presentation of Lucky Luciano, one of the most influential and powerful men in American history, and certainly one of the most notorious and infamous criminals of all time. This has been another edition of the Bareback Facts. I am your host, Dallas Big D Duclo, and I will return on Friday with our presentation of the Casanova Killer. Until then, you guys, enjoy the rest of your week. And remember...